AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence.
This is AutoLine After Hours with John McElroy, episode 48 for Thursday, March 25th, 2010, Invasion of the Pod Cars. Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLineDetroit.tv every Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time or 2300 hours GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine After Hours in the iTunes Store. Here we are. It's Thursday night. It's AutoLine After Hours again. And as I start off every show, I turn to the extremist sitting on my right here, Mr. Auto Extremist, Peter DeLorenzo.
Buongiorno, Johnny.
Is it good to be here?
It is. It's great to be alive.
It's great to be alive and talking cars in the car industry. And also joining us today is Frank Marcus from Motor Trend Magazine. Frank, it's great having you here, too.
Always a lot of fun.
I know you've been on the show before, but I was not here the last time you were here, so this is a first for me having you on the show. And we've also got Tom Walsh from the Detroit Free Press here. Tom, great having you.
Happy spring.
Doesn't feel like spring outside here
not
in Detroit today.
But
today.
It's pretty nice. But
it's Indian winter. We had a little spring a couple of days ago.
Right. So, Peter, let's talk about your column a bit. You went after Cadillac returning to their science and technology
art
roots.
And science.
Art and science.
Well, it's fine, but it's not enough. I mean, they've spent, guesstimates were initial $4 billion, subsequently another $4 billion.
To get the product right.
You know, over a decade. And now, just when they think, well, you know, we kind of got it going on, now is when they really have to dump a lot more money in it, give Cadillac serious autonomy, make no excuses products, and I just think that they've got a long way to go, and they got to show me, they got to jump in and really step it up. And I don't think the company's really, I think the company thinks, hey, we're almost there, but I think they got to step it up, because if you spend any time in the latest Audis and stuff, it's just like, come on, guys, if you want to really compete, you got to step it up.
Talk about why you think they need autonomy.
Well, I've been saying this for a while, but I think GM is a tainted brand. I mean, just people hear GM and it's bad. It's going to be bad for a long time. Break Cadillac off. Cadillac has too many, you know, listen, they've got some great dealers, but they've got too many bad dealers, and they've got to really transform their whole image. And the less time they spend mentioning that they're attached to GM, the better, in my estimation.
They are pulling the GM badges off the fender, right?
It's a Cadillac website, so you have to go to Cadillac instead of going through GM. They're doing all kinds of things, but, boy, they got a tough road. They've got some great products, though.
They do have good products, and they've got some good products coming that we know, that we've seen. The XTS, which has been confirmed for production.
The B Series, whatever they...
Yeah, they're sort of 3-series BMW fighter, rear drive, long front nose on the thing.
Because the CTS is weird. The CTS is between the 5 and the 3 in size. Mm-hmm. This new Cadillac is definitely 3.
Right. But, you know, what I wonder is that all the products that we're talking about came out under Lutz or were developed when Lutz was still running the product development show. I'm not so sure I like the way I see things going at GM right now, again, with nobody in charge of any of the divisions.
Give Royce a little chance to get going, though. I think he's totally up to the task of filling those shoes.
No, I would agree with that, but he can't do it all. Yeah. And that's the problem I see right now is no one's in charge of the division.
Well, everything. And I think that's particularly a problem for Cadillac, which does have to set itself apart more so than the others. I mean, I think they can still do it within GM, and you know, the business about everybody has to have different email addresses and everything. I'm not sure I buy all of that. But there's no, I don't know who stands for Cadillac in the company. You know, they brought Nesbitt out of design. Okay, it's Nesbitt now, but now Nesbitt's back to design. So I don't even know who's, you know.
Well, I think
who's Cadillac? You know,
nobody's in charge of Cadillac.
Right.
You know, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And I agree with what you're saying, Frank, is that I've got all the confidence in the world in Mark Royce. But Mark Royce can't be the whole corporation. That's the problem.
Well, we had him on before. We need to get him back.
We need to get him back.
Have
on.
Mark say,
that's right.
Mark, please explain.
Right.
But, I think I'm sure GM isn't thinking like this, but I'm thinking now they really have to dump a boatload of more money in Cadillac. You know, they're right on the verge. Now they have to just really go for it, and I don't think they're ready for that. They're too busy talking about paying off the government, and, you know, they're going to make an announcement, I guess, next week. They're giving another chunk of money back, and I guess that's their lot in life until they get out from under it.
They're probably sick of hearing. I mean, I don't know how many comments on our website are all about, you know, well, yeah, the government's this and government motors that. And, you know, I think they want that behind them.
They have to get it behind them to make any progress.
Right. But as we all know, your seed corn is your future product investment.
Yeah.
And that should not be sacrificed for anything. Nothing. No. It's the kiss of death in this business.
Well, that says everything should be fine, but... God, you know, Bob's such a presence.
Well, and, yeah, his absence now. I mean, this is the test. I mean, okay, Tom Stevens got to step up. Royce has to step up, and let's see where the product goes now. And then who speaks for it? You know, because Lutz could sort of jump in and speak for everything. Well, it's not the same talking to some of the other guys.
No, it isn't.
And like, I keep coming back to this. There's no one in charge of any of the divisions. No one. There is a sales manager. There's a marketing manager. The product stuff all goes through engineering, the manufacturing. You know, no one is in charge of Cadillac. And if any one division really absolutely needs someone in charge, someone with the vision, someone to drive all that. Now, it's got to be Mark Royce, but he's also got to do it for Chevrolet and for Buick and for GMC. And that's a lot to have on your plate, I think.
And it seems even within some of those other disciplines that even engineering is more split. There's a head of engineering powertrain and a head of engineering that. There's not a one guy to replace Jim Queen. And part of it is just new people and sort of trying to figure out who's doing what. But I spent some time the other day with Bob Socha, the new head of purchasing. And he's doing a lot of stuff, and he's got the engineering guys meeting with the suppliers, but there's multiple. It's like a three-headed monster.
Well, let's set the Wayback Machine to Detroit in 1959. Look at the lineup at Pontiac. Bunky Knutson was the general manager. The buck stopped with him and his chief engineer with John Z. DeLorean, with legendary guys like Bill Collins and Russ G. working. I mean, it's just like, wow. And boy, you know. It's not lamenting the good old days or anything. It's just like there was a time where it was done the right way. I believe it can be done again, but it's scattered right now. There's no doubt. Mm-hmm. And without that presence of Lutz, the lightning rod, they need a lightning rod. Without him, it's, you know, they're floundering.
Well, we'll have to give them time. We have to give them the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah.
You know, they're doing it. We're sitting outside. We don't have all the information that they have.
And you know, Lutz was kind of running a lot more, you know, riding herd on more brands. So, you know, I mean, it's not out of the question that it'll work. But, you're absolutely right. I mean, it would be nice to have a go-to guy.
Well, like I said, a lot of what Lutz did, people outside the business don't know. It was the behind-the-curtain stuff and product development that he did, which is why he believes they're in good stead right now, because they fixed all of that. He worked hard on that. But, you know, Lutz comes along just once in a while. So.
Well, my prediction is sometime in the next 24 months, they'll announce yet another reorganization, and they will appoint executives in charge of each of the car brands. That's my prediction.
And then let's hope they stick with it, because, you know, there's nothing worse than, you know, multiple reorgs constantly, you know, shaking up everything, because it seems like it takes, you know, many months for the dust to settle and, you know, everyone to start pulling in the same direction again. I was at Chrysler for a couple of major reorgs, and I know every time it was just like everything went up in the air and it didn't settle down, you know, for a long time after. factor.
Well, think about it. GM's been doing this since the John Smale days.
Well, if you really want to go back, since 1984,
right.
General Motors has been reorganizing on,
right.
On a fairly constant basis
and, under
and never got it right.
Like the Frankfurt Airport.
Yeah.
Hey, other news that's going on or continuing to go on, Tom, this sudden unintended acceleration issue that's hit Toyota and now all the other recalls involved, and now it looks like there's this gigantomundo class action lawsuit coming down.
$40 billion.
Somebody threw out a figure of $40 billion. What do you make of this?
I think it's just open season for lawyers. And I was listening to one of the NPR reports on this, you know, the jockeying among the lawyers and the law firms around the country, and they're all going to these seminars to get stuff explained to them so that they can jockey to be in whatever position they are, you know, with the judges on, you know, who gets appointed to what, and that, you know, and they all get a third of whatever they get. It just sounds terribly forbidding for Toyota. I mean, I've been thinking, okay, it's bad. They screwed it up. You know, it's going to cost them a few billion dollars, but it may cost tens of billions.
It's going to drag out. It's going to drag out a long time. Now, they still have their loyalist buyers.
Right.
And that's where they're gearing all their advertising, which we discussed last week.
Right.
But this is going to hang over Toyota for years. I mean, look at our legal system. I mean, it's going to be a nightmare.
I still say, you know, the pockets are deep enough that Toyota will get beyond this way quicker than Audi ever did, because they didn't have the money to pour into it. They didn't have as many folks coming at them either, because they didn't have all this class action nonsense. But I have a feeling we're going to hear from somebody that says, you know what, resale value was not cast in stone. Things happen. I'm not sure that's going to, do you think that's going to really get a lot of traction?
I don't know about that, but I
it's never worked in the past.
Yeah.
I mean, everyone who's tried that has failed. So
there'll just be this black cloud. There'll be like this undertone in the media. And in about page six, the business section, some lawsuit you'll be reading about 4 years from now.
But meanwhile, you know, they've cranked up to, you know, unprecedented incentives. And guess what?
Yeah.
The sales are going, because people, you know, I'm scared for my family. Except, man, that's a good deal.
Yeah.
I mean, you know.
Yeah, it's just their scorched earth policy with their incentives. I mean, they've got deep pockets. And it's roiling the business. I mean, here is Detroit just finally getting to the point where they're getting their transaction prices up. They're getting people to actually go in and say, well, this is a good product and there's value attached to it. It's not the deal.
Yeah.
Now Toyota is going to blow it up real good and send them all back to the deal. And that couldn't come at a worse time for GM, Ford, and Chrysler.
The irony, of course, though, is that, as you guys know, anytime you start heaping incentives on a car, it hurts the resale value.
Yeah.
It hurts the residuals. Which is why they're being sued, right?
Yeah.
Because the residuals are going down, and now they're going to fix it by offering incentives that'll drive down the residuals.
In our Simpson sedan comparison test, they only beat the Ford and the Chevy in terms of resale value. The Hyundai has overtaken them. You know, the Nissan, the Honda, you know, all of them. So,
what about Honda announcing that they're, for the first time, like, all in on all their products?
Well, and they're announcing it, you know, a week or so before the month ends. So, I mean, what their dealers are doing is screaming, we're getting killed out here. Everybody's running to go buy a Toyota right now. We need to have something to compete. And this is the danger for this industry that thought, finally, we can put all these incentives behind us and go out and make some money, finally. And now this is going to hurt big time. But as I said last week, I believe Toyota is only bringing in loyalists. I don't think they're bringing in that 50% of people who are new to the brand, who are now going, whoa, yeah, the deal's good, but let's look and see what else is out there. So my belief is they're going to pull forward a bunch of loyalists, and then somewhere in the middle of the summer, they're going to run into a sales problem. Toyota is. That's my prediction.
No, I totally agree.
I think that's probably right. Yeah.
But, you know, I keep coming back to this $40 billion figure. I mean, if that ever happened. Now, this is the guy who's leading the class action lawsuit charge, right?
Yeah.
So, but I know what you guys are saying, deep pockets and all that, but I'm telling you, that would cripple that company, not hurt it, cripple it, if that was a $40 billion tag.
It's a big number, and we're still close enough to, you know, the explosive, you know, inferno of this story that, you know, we haven't had any real separation. I mean, it didn't seem like the Ford Explorer and the tires, the Firestone tire thing was ever going to end for a while. And then it did, and it just sort of went away. I mean, it didn't kill anybody. Sort of killed Firestone for a while, the brand, but didn't kill Ford. And I don't think this will kill Toyota either. But
no,
they're going to have a tough year or two.
Well, it won't kill them. No, they won't go out of business. But, you know, to sue over the fact that the value of your car went down when, I mean, you're only going to realize this loss if and when you go and sell your car. So I don't know how you can collect on damages when you haven't been damaged yet. And maybe that comes back to your argument, Frank, that no one's ever really been successful at this.
Yeah.
I hope you're right, because I think this is really dangerous precedent.
Yeah.
Did any of you see this press conference that took place in Washington on Tuesday with Joan Claybrook moderating it? It's like the trial attorneys, the plaintiff attorneys, are getting worried that now the cause of unintended acceleration, now people are starting to say, oh, it's driver error, and they have to put the big kibosh on this and make sure that it's absolutely this mysterious problem that
sunspots.
No one's ever been able to
the
find.
Electron.
Right.
Yeah. And cosmic rays.
And
right.
What were we talking about? Where are the reports outside of the U.S.?
Well, I got a very interesting email from a viewer, Richard Sutherland. And I don't know if, Richard, if you're out there right now, but he just sent a very simple email and says, does this stuff happen outside of the United States, sudden unintended acceleration? And I put in a call to Toyota to see if, you know, there was anything like that outside of the U.S. and what they said. In fact, I'm picking up my email right now. And what they've said is there are some cases of reported unintended acceleration outside of the United States, but it's like a fraction of what's going on here. So what's that about?
The media landscapes are slightly different in all these places. I think that's what you're really starting to see, is these people...
The frenzy.
Yeah, wanting to get in on the circling sharks and get my TV moment and, you know, get out of my five payments behind on my, you know, Prius and, you know, et cetera.
But I think there's something that's got to be looked into in this. Why isn't this happening all over Germany or all over England? I suspect it's happening in Canada.
There's less driver error in countries where it costs $2,000 to get your license and you have to actually do more than fog a mirror to be turned loose in, you know, two-ton, you know, hurtling vehicles.
See, I think you're absolutely right. And that's where I was getting with this, and it comes back to what we talked before. If you really want to reduce traffic accidents, all this trade that we play around with is crazy, because we still know today 60% of everybody killed in a traffic accident is not wearing their seatbelt. So you want to save lives? It's real easy. Make everybody buckle up. You might save 20,000 lives a year, not the two people killed every year on average in a Toyota due to unintended acceleration. And to me, it's just madness.
Well, think about the billions and billions of dollars this government, the country, has imposed on the U.S. industry for safety stuff, which, granted, is, you know, most of it is progress. But what if they took a fraction of those billions and institute a national driver education policy that was actually had some teeth to it, actually had some value? How many lives would be saved then? I mean, I would predict it would be transform this whole country. And John, we could get to those 100-mile-an-hour speed limits then.
Then we can, yeah. But remember, it's 150-mile-an-hour
right.
speed limit that I want.
Right.
And I'm dead serious about that. I really am. But yeah. Great driver's ed. I've always felt, you know, if you could get to like the Bob Bondurant type driving school, and I don't mean the racing thing that he does. I mean where they set you out and teach you how to do threshold braking and emergency J turns and put you on those coasters so that it feels like you're on glare ice. Mm-hmm. And I'm telling you, a half hour of that and you start to learn how to control skids beautifully well. It becomes second nature.
Well, let's face it. There are people who have never put their brakes on hard.
Yeah.
Right.
Never triggered ABS.
Yeah, and they, you know, literally if you set aside somewhere where you could go and just say, now go 50 miles an hour and put the brakes on as hard as you can. I mean, people have never done that until the accident they had.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, it's just, you know, yeah, we don't need ultra-intense, you know, Bondurant racing schools, but you could do national driver education training centers and not make it painful, you know, make it a day session or something, or a three-day session over a year, you know, once every 3 months you go, and then at the end, and have graded licenses. If you just want to drive around and go to the supermarket, you get one grade. If you actually demonstrate competence, you can do other things. Like maybe you can go 80, you know.
Right. Well, at the very least, everybody, before they get their driver's license, should have driven in rush hour traffic, should have driven on the highway, should have driven at night, should have driven in the snow if you live in the snow belt, and so on and so forth. I didn't go through any of that getting my driver's license, and guess what? It's even worse
today. I didn't
today.
Need a driver, Ed. And all I did was back out of a big parking spot, make three right turns, four, back into the same parking spot, never crack 20 miles an hour. You're good to go as a 16-year-old idiot. I mean, come on.
I was fortunate. My parents traveled a lot, so I would take the car out at 14 in the snow so I could learn how to slide it. And that was fun. But, you know, I learned quick.
Right. Well, you know, we either lived in an era or in an area where you could go do that sort of thing. But, yeah, we'd take my brother Jim and I'd always take my dad's station wagon out by our cottage. It's all dirt roads. And learned how to do four-wheel drifts, learned how to do handbrake turns, learned how to slide a car around a turn. There was nobody around. If you lost control, you mowed down a bunch of corn stalks. Big deal.
Yeah.
But that's not – it's hard to find situations like that.
And you see that now the next, you know, frontier on these safety equipment is take the idiot out of the equation.
Oh, yeah.
Take over. You know, you better get the radar that really knows you're about to have a wreck and torpedo the brakes automatically if the guy isn't paying attention.
Oh, yeah. You know, well, Larry Burns, you know, from the ex-GM guys talking about this utopia where we approach the city limits and you just flip the switch and you're done driving. It's all, you know, and you know, if that happens, just shoot me.
Well, you know, we saw it this week. GM came out with these little pod cars that they introduced in Shanghai that they're calling Envy. You know, what is it, electric network vehicle or something like that. But what I find is amusing is Chrysler had an electric car group called Envy, mm-hmm. and now GM's got Envy. It doesn't have the I on the end, but what do you make of these pod cars? Well, I don't have to ask you. You just told me.
Frank makes a rational point about it, but, you know, I just, this invasion of the clown cars, I mean, where does it end? You know, I don't know.
I don't think we are really prepared to understand what those are about. I think if you live in a city like Shanghai, which is going to have, you know, 40 million people in some whatever area that is, all of whom are trying to increase their standard of living and want to get around on their own, having these little things. I mean, they are about the size of six pedestrians and about the weight of six pedestrians. So a pedestrian bridge, that kind of structure will accommodate, you know, herds of these things.
Plus it eliminates mopeds or those
kind of
cycles.
Although they could go with those.
But they want to eliminate those for the pollution stuff.
Well, yeah, or make them electric also, whatever. But the things are, you know, they'll go park themselves. So it's like automatic valet parking anywhere you go.
There it is.
Yeah. So,
yeah, we have it up on the screen there.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to them that I think will really be great. And we were talking earlier, you know, when you say, well, yeah, how are you going to keep your infrastructure smooth enough for basically a Segway with no suspension to tolerate it? And what about the grades and all that? And they said, well, really, it's a bespoke system. So the city needs to be built for these things. And that's not a problem because they're building new cities at a rate of like one a month in China. So you just, at some point, you go, all right, make the next couple of them, you know, Envy, you know, compliant, and okay, you know, great.
Shiny, happy, smiley cars.
Right.
The end is near.
And you can video conference with your pals while you're riding along, you know, I mean, like they say, driving is a distraction for some giant number of people.
Well, there's a big movement, I tell you, there's a big movement afoot that's going to, you know, the vehicles will be programmed and we won't be able to drive them.
Well, you know, I've argued all along in favor of autonomous cars because it will revolutionize the automobile as a transportation conveyance. Because now you can give your little kids the car keys to go play with their friends. And elderly people, you know, I'm talking senior citizens.
Senile.
Can now get around, no problem with something like that. And what it should be able to do is open up the roads for enthusiasts like us to go 150 miles an hour.
Well,
like
that's the optimum thing. I hope it works that way. But somehow the governments involved are going to screw it up somehow.
All I know is, too, I hope that it still is possible for you to drive your Citroen and me to drive my Maserati, well, which is not going to be automated. No way.
They're never going to.
Well, John wants still the places where you get 150 miles an hour.
Yeah.
And that'll make sense. And it's all back to the future. I mean, we had all this before. It was called streetcars. And little kids could go and get on the streetcar and go all over town. And old people could get on the streetcar and go all over town. Streetcars are gone in America. And, you know, we're trying to bring them back in Detroit. But
Well, if there are pod car lanes, and then it, you're right, John, if it opens up for, you know, people like us who wheel their stuff out of the garage, if they're pod car lanes and it frees up, you know, for fast, you know, actually driven vehicles, that's fine. I'm just afraid.
We'll pass a law, Peter, and you and I will start working on the legislation right now that the pod cars automatically have to move into the right lane when we come whizzing by.
Well, actually, there will be only pod car lanes. They do not stray from.
And they might be elevated, again, just because, you know, they're out of the way that way and they can do their own thing and they don't have to worry about, you know, a stray, you know, out of control Citroen, you know, hurtling into the pod car lanes that way and so forth.
Well, they
also were mentioning that, you know, that might be the approach for, like, national parks, too, where you want it quiet and you don't want any fumes and whatever. Maybe you get little fleets of these to roll around in there. And
sure.
Then, sure, great, sure. Fine.
That's great. But, you know, look, I've seen fully autonomous cars working. DARPA put on the DARPA challenge. These things are regular vehicles. It can drive anywhere.
That's a regular vehicle loaded down to about 4 tons with all the, you know, stuff.
Yeah, but, you know, they'll get down all that miniaturized. They'll get it down to the size of a laptop.
The vehicle offloads half of that stuff.
Sure. And, you know, TARDEC right now is really pushing it from a military standpoint. They've got this pretty cool autonomous vehicle that it's amazing. This thing will go anywhere, do anything kind of thing. And so I'm all for bringing autonomy in. In fact, Audi, we know, is even working on a Pikes Peak race car to have a fully autonomous car race at Pikes Peak. So, I mean, the capabilities coming on very, very quickly. Well, you got to do that anyway.
Equipped with parachutes just in case it goes off the edge.
Hey, some of the other news that came out this week is Carbon Motors, this company that's building this purpose-built police car, announced that they're getting all these engines, 250,000 engines they signed up.
Over who knows what period of time.
Over who knows. From BMW. They're getting inline turbo diesels and transmissions. But does Carbon have a chance in hell of really breaking into this market?
Well, they're operating under the supposition that they're going to get this money from the government. And what are they going to get? Instantly 10% of the police car market, which is, 60,000 vehicles a year? That means that they just signed up with BMW for enough engines for 25 years or something. I mean, I don't know. And, John, you made a real good point. I mean, they made all the mistakes they could possibly make. They went and talked to the police agencies and said, what do you want? And they just crammed it all in, and now at the price point that it's...
Well, they have, you know, at least, I'm sure any municipality that asks their police department which one they want, they're all going to say, we want that one. Because they are tailored, like no regular purpose, you know, family car converted to police duty could possibly be. You know, with the carriage doors in the back and the, you know, PVC molded rear seats and the, you know, just everything about that car is, you know, honed perfectly. And the other thing that's interesting, it is going to be expensive, but that car, the purchase price, which will probably be, I don't know, they haven't announced it, but it's probably 70 grand or something like that.
Yeah, more like 80 is like.
70 to 80.
Yeah.
But it comes with all the lights. It comes with your graphics on it. It's turnkey, ready to go on patrol the minute it rolls in. And when you're done with it, you just hand it back. And they decommission it. You don't, because they used to spend a lot of money pulling all that crap off and then trying to sell it and whatever. It's cradle to grave. It's handled. It never goes into the back into service. There will be no Bluesmobile carbon E7s, you know.
But, you know, the bottom line, though, is, you know, look at all the communities all across the country cutting their budgets. They don't have the financial wherewithal to deal with something like that. And John made a good point. If they can get their Chevy Impala or the new Ford Taurus serviced at the local dealer, or they have to ship it, the carbon thing, back, it's just not going to work.
Oh, they'll have some, you know, localized service arrangement worked out.
But, you know, that's why so many police departments have bought Crown Vicks forever and ever and ever. They know them inside out and backwards. Their people know how to work on them. They got all the tools. It's just going to be hard for them to break away from that. And yeah, probably the life cycle cost that Carbon Motors is talking about is very attractive, but you got to pay the upfront cost to get it. It's like Nissan talking about how great the EV Leaf is going to be. On a total life cycle basis, they're absolutely right. But it's that upfront cost that most people are not going to be able to get over, at least not initially.
Right.
So that's the problem I see that Carbon is facing here.
I think they're wildly optimistic.
I just like the fact that if you see that in the rearview mirror, it is a cop.
It looks like
or
Robo.
It's Homeland Security. It is not, you know, somebody, you know, in a black Crown Vic that sprayed his, you know, grill black. You know to be scared if that's in the rearview mirror.
Also, it's right out of RoboCop, so there's that.
Yeah. It's cool looking, you got to say.
Well, hey, look, they got BMW to commit to 250,000 engines. I wonder if that involved upfront money to get that.
Well, maybe the BMW committed to the press conference, and we'll see. You know, you want to say that, right? Well, let's just talk about
that. 250,000 is an awful lot. Yeah.
That's a lot of engines. Remember the last time BMW sold an inline turbo six to an outside company?
The Vixen.
No.
Oh, that's one, too. You remember the little camper with the pusher?
The Vixen was very cool.
That was a cool motorhome.
Bill Collins.
Bill Collins did that, who also did the GTO. And
which one were you thinking of?
No, I'm thinking of, if you remember, I want to say it was the Mark 7 Lincoln.
Oh.
And I want to say
10 of them.
Ford signed up for a boatload of turbos from BMW. And, yeah, they sold about six, and that was that. But Ford paid BMW big time because they signed up for a whole multi-year contract. And BMW just held the paper up and said, sorry, boys, but you owe us some money here. So I'll have to look that up, but that's a little trivia fact.
That Vixen was really cool.
The garage full RV?
Yeah, it was very cool. Boy, if they had some real money behind that, that was way out in front.
Well, it was cool, but we're none RV buyers saying how cool it was.
Yeah.
The RV crowd just never warmed up to it.
Well, yeah, because it was, you know.
I don't know if you could stand up in it, could you?
I don't know.
It had a pop-up top, didn't it?
No.
I think that was why it was garageable.
Uh-uh.
Well, there it is. Look at that. Wow, how
good.
No,
amazing.
Is that the Vixen?
Yeah,
is that the GM?
No,
yeah,
that's
no,
that
is
a
Vixen,
yeah, yeah.
Right.
Huh.
Well, the GM motor.
It does have a pop-up top, see?
Yeah,
the GM motorhome was very successful.
The GMC motorhome.
Yeah, GMC motorhome.
That was a futuristic look. In fact, if you see them today, they still look pretty good.
Yeah, they still look good.
If you put on modern headlights and a few other things.
Well, there's a club of them. I mean, there's several clubs.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we should have an AAH at one of their club meets.
One other news item that we ought to touch on that I thought was pretty interesting. Tom, I don't know if you saw this, but some exec at Honda came out this week and saying joint ventures and alliances between different car companies are a waste of time because they lead to inefficiency. Did you see that?
Well, I mean, Honda has a long and storied history of going it alone and with pretty good results. So, you know, they don't see any reason to change. And you know, the ground is, you know, filled with the wreckage of all those other alliances. So,
and here we have Daimler and Renault.
Renault are about to tie up.
A weird 3% sharing of love. I don't know what it is.
These guys are looking at Airbus and going, man, we want what they got? I mean, the French-German thing, I don't know. Yeah.
Something going on with Daimler. I mean, they always seem to be looking for something. I mean, it's just...
They're doing something in China with BYD and another Chinese company whose name escapes me right now. No, you're right.
It's just,
if anybody's got the technical wherewithal to do anything they want on their own, it's Daimler. I mean, those guys are good.
Yeah, it's just strange. But Carlos has been, you know, he just can't help himself. He wants something to happen. So this 3% sharing or trade, I mean, it's just strange.
Well, I will say, I think Renault and Nissan have worked it out pretty well. And they've done so because they've kept the two entities very, 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 very separate. And there is an equity swap between the two. But there's been platform sharing and some component sharing, but not a whole lot. And they seem to have made it work. And I wonder if that's the way that you do it, is don't try to merge everything and don't try to share every single platform and the like. But maybe... If you keep each organization and its own culture allowed to continue as it always has, you can make that work.
What if GM and Carlos had made that deal? What would have happened? I think
they would have dragged Renault down with them.
That's what I think.
Because I think they would have gone bankrupt anyway.
It would have been a disaster.
I would think, yeah. And I don't, for all of the synergies of Renault and Nissan, and the way they talk about, well, it's worked okay. I think okay is the right word. It's worked okay, but you haven't seen any tremendous growth out of these companies, right? I mean, okay, they've been able to kind of muddle along and be profitable. But meanwhile, you know, Hyundai's up kicking their butt just like they are everybody else's. It's not like, you know, they've leaped out ahead with this alliance.
Short story for Honda, as I agree with whoever said that for Honda. I hope they stay independent.
And I think Honda has been unique right since it was formed. I mean, right. Mr. Honda, Soichiro, didn't get along with any of those other people. He dressed funny, and they were kind of over on their own right from the get-go.
He was in the going
fast. Well, remember,
fast.
Meaty, yep. The Ministry of International Trade and Industry, did not want Toyota or Honda to build cars.
Yes. Right. And now they're building jets and God knows what all else, and that stuff, you know, could happen there.
That,
you know?
Jet is very cool.
When are we going to get our first little test ride on that?
I don't know.
I am dying to ride in that thing.
It looks cool.
I have given it ink. I need
almost
a ride in that.
It's thing. Almost garageable, too.
But yeah, I think Honda is able to go alone because they've got so many other businesses, motorcycles, power products, jets, you know, all this other stuff. So they're a fairly diversified company, even though it all comes down to engines.
Engines, yeah, that's the thing.
It's the motor company, although they have lost their way of late. They really have. That new CRZ is really not what that should have been.
And the inside is tanking, and there's design. I haven't really had any hits lately that way in the automotive space.
You know, and they had that one executive who's in charge now say, oh, it's all about economy now. And, you know, I like it better when Honda's racing and innovating and inventing. You know, I think this, you know, pulling back and just, oh, we got to really work on efficiency. That's not
and
the way.
And cancellation of the NSX and the S2000 are kind of like, oh.
Oh, yeah. The S2000, one of the great sports cars of all time. And that was painful. They should have done a successor to it. Same thing, same drive configuration, lighter. You know,
Well, think about it. You know, they probably are thinking, we really never made any money on the NSX. We probably never made any money on the S2000. I know. Let's do the cross tour. I don't think they're going to make any money on that. And even though the CRZ has now become this hot commodity in Japan.
Well, that's, you know, that. What does that say about the Toyota car consumer?
Well, not only that, but, you know,
car buyers.
Well, but I mean, you know, Japan's got these hot and heavy incentives on hybrids right now, and Toyota's in big trouble. So, but, you know, based on what I've read of what people here in the U.S. and Europe have written about the CRZ, it's only going to sell in Japan. I don't see it selling here.
Concept was very nice, and then they, you know, they bring that. It was just like, oh, what happened?
What happened is exactly right.
Yeah.
Hey, I think it's time we ought to get to rapid fire. Ben, bring it up. It's rapid fire here, so we get about a minute each to go with our viewers' questions. Dana Lewis writes in to say, you're harping on the GM Envy, but what was that thing Honda just introduced a week or two ago, the Honda 3RC?
It looks like a motorcycle with two front wheels, one seat. The windshield kind of covers everything up when you park it. No detail on that thing at all. So that's much less of a real project. All I could get them to tell me was length, width, and height of the thing. But it's electric. But I think the footprint of that is probably very similar, maybe a little bit narrower, a little bit longer, you know, than this Envy. So I'm not terribly impressed with that one.
Okay, George from Brooklyn says, how long does Ram survive outside of Dodge?
Boy, that's a good question. I hate to say it, but every time Fred Diaz says something in the paper, it sounds bad. And I wish them all the luck, but boy, they, you know, and we didn't talk about Chrysler sales. I mean, they're saying we're up 51% retail over last month. Wait a minute. You sold 60% fleet sales last month. I hope you're up from last month retail sales. So they're still throwing out numbers and playing fast and loose with what they're doing. And then, you know, the net is they're down 12% from a year ago.
Well, the real question, does Dodge last outside of Ram?
Yeah.
That's a great point, Frank. That is, because they make the money on the trucks.
Hello.
You bet.
Well, as long as they stop putting $8,000 on the hood, they make money on the trucks.
Frank B. wants to know, don't any of the Toyotas being recalled have manual transmissions? If so, have there been any problems with vehicles that are equipped with them? Frank, we don't think so. We have not found one. Maybe they're out there, but we have not found one case of unintended acceleration with a manual transmission car.
On any car.
Their footwork is a much better sorted out.
Right, which comes back to driver error. It's not this bogus, funny kind of electronic ghost thing that's going on. I'm sorry, I just don't see it that way. Let's see. When do you expect Washington to impose a national texting ban?
Soon. Well, states will do it first. Somebody will do it. It's coming. It's coming real fast. Michigan's about to do it, aren't we?
Yeah.
How do you enforce that? Is anyone stupid enough to text up in the window?
Well, I mean, same way you enforce seatbelt laws. You know.
Well, you could see the seatbelt. You know, I mean, unless you're stupid enough to drive along, those bands all seem kind of silly to me. I don't know.
Remember when you used to see people driving with the seatbelt buckled behind them?
Yeah.
So they wouldn't have to.
When the buzzers were really annoying. Yeah.
I'm just blown away that we have to pass a law that says, you know, you can't text when you drive. I'm amazed we have to tell people that. But, hey, we got a phone. In fact, we've got a number of phone calls. Ben, let's bring up one of them. Oh, we have technical issues. Okay, well, we'll get to another question and then bring that up in a minute, though. Kevin says, you cannot have too stringent of driver education when there is no real public transportation alternative, trains, et cetera. That's a point. I mean, that's a point. In America, everybody's got to be able to drive because we don't have public transportation and there is no way to go to your job if you don't have your own set of wheels in many cases. But all I would say is 35,000 fatalities a year, and I think a lot of that could be handled with vigorous seatbelt enforcement and better driver training.
Warren Buffett just bought a railroad.
There you go.
Can we get one of those phone calls in here?
Hi, John. This is GM employee, a.k.a. Borger. Just put a quick question. What do you guys think or feel about GM making a second government loan payment? Do you think GM is going to pull out and pay off all debt within a timely manner? Just want your thoughts on that. Have a good day.
I think GM is going to try to put as much money back to the government as soon as they possibly can, because until they get out from under it, they will be tainted. They will be hamstrung. We just had the the pays are, say, well, you guys, you know, it's okay for these guys to make over $500,000, but the rest of you, you're done. You know, they got to get out from under.
Well, they'll make the loan payments, and they'll do it pretty quickly. The IPO is a different ball of wax entirely, getting out from under that equity.
Yeah.
The market's helping them right now. The market's been strong. And, you know, we've seen the big run-up in Ford stock. And if they can get they don't even have to do a full IPO, but if they were able to unload some of that equity and the public would start to say, oh, okay, I guess they're serious, I think it would help them get past it. But they're not going to do a big, huge, major IPO and get rid of all of it anytime soon.
Do you think that they can pay back every single dime that they ever took from the government, the $50 billion plus?
It's hard to imagine that, but if the market gets on a roll and people get excited about it, you know, I think what you're going to see now, this is sort of a little off topic, but now that healthcare is behind them on the federal government and they got to go talk about jobs and they got to talk about midterm elections, you're going to see this administration, I don't know if it'll work, but you're going to see them brag about what they've done in the auto space as their biggest domestic success. You know, they got them in and out of bankruptcy in the time they said they would, and they're still alive. And cash for clunkers sort of worked. We'll see if it flies or not. And we'll see, because the public is still fairly anti-bailout and anti-government
motor. Oh, yeah, motor. Very much so, I would say. Okay, Jeremy Jones from Dallas wants to know, does Peter own that green car on his website?
Yes, I do. No further comment.
Okay, Ben, let's bring in another one of the people who are calling in.
Hey, guys, this is John from Atlanta. Enjoy the show. Peter, I really enjoyed your article this week. I had a kind of comment and question for you. I wonder what your thoughts were on Bob Lutz's success at Cadillac and his tenure since he kind of came back to GM. I was a big fan of the audacious styling in the early arts and science era, kind of like a Kip was because of the car and the CTS. And I was also kind of let down by what came out after the STF. The thing I remember at the time was that Bob Lutz really didn't seem to like the CTS when he first saw it. I remember the rumors and Ward's and I believe Auto News that he had even gone so far as to say that he was telling suppliers to cut back to, say, 20,000 units, and clearly did a lot better than that. All in all, I'm generally a big fan of Bob Lutz, but I was really curious what your thoughts were on what happened and kind of the mixed bag of results we've seen from Cadillac. Thanks again. I enjoyed the show.
I think Bob didn't like the first CTS. He liked the second one. I mean, obviously, he had input the second one. I think a lot of people, I think probably everyone in this panel tonight, remember the 16 and was kind of hoping that there would be a vehicle. I mean, just to have a flagship American sedan to go up against a Rolls, or just, you know, so what, they make only 100 of them a year or maybe 50. I think a lot of enthusiasts out there really like the Cadillac design language and would have loved to have seen at least an attempt at doing the 16 or something like it. And I think as much as we like the XTS in the flesh, a lot of readers wrote in and said, why, you know, it's okay, but why can't we have a 16-like vehicle? Why can't we have an American flagship that everyone around the world says, wow, that is cool, and that's an American luxury? And I kind of agree with that. But, you know, obviously if they had done that and then gone bankrupt, everyone would say, it's guys like you caused that company to go bankrupt. All you enthusiasts, you want all these damn cars and nobody can afford you. Yeah, whatever.
Okay, Mike DeWhite says, Mazda says it's going to have an idle stop tech for all of it. I think he's talking about stop start for all its cars by 2015. Is this a good idea? Will the technology catch on?
The trouble with those things are they don't show up very much on the EPA cycle. In real world, obviously, you save money when the engine isn't running, but the engine doesn't, it wouldn't have a chance to turn off very often in EPA cycles. So that's why there have been less of a rush to jump on that bandwagon here. Some of the other cycles around the world give a lot more credit for that.
That's a great point. There is only one or two stops in the city cycle on EPA.
Yeah.
So if you're not coming to a stop, your engine doesn't shut off
in the
drive cycle, the EPA test cycle, so you don't get a bump on the fuel economy label. Excellent point. Jim wants to know, so what do we hear about Saab now that they have Spyker running it? I think now without GM, they only have two different cars to sell. How much is the government going to dump in it to keep it going?
Well, Spyker's making noise that they've got some partners lined up. So I don't know what's going on with that.
All I'll say is watch Autoline Detroit this weekend. We have Mike Colleran, the president of Saab Cars USA, on. They actually have a little bit more product coming. It's more than two cars. They have the 9.3. They have the 9.3X, which is sort of like the station wagon, what they used to call the sport combi. It's a little bit different. There's a brand new 9.5 coming that looks pretty damn good. They also have the 9.4X, which is a crossover version of the Cadillac SRX. And in fact, GM will continue to build this vehicle under contract for Saab. They're looking at doing something smaller. I don't know if it would be like a new Sonet or something like that. So there is some stuff coming from Saab. They're not totally out of the ballgame.
Well, didn't Saab develop that really advanced all-wheel drive system that is in the SRX?
That I don't know. Saab's center of excellence for General Motors was always turbocharging, turbo four-cylinder. So, but the all-wheel drive system, that I don't know. But my question is, Saab will now live off all this product that General Motors developed for it, and that General Motors spent several billion dollars developing for Saab. Next generation, Saab's going to have to pay all the bills, and that's where the real test as to whether this company can survive or not comes through.
And not a lot of synergies with the Spykers.
None whatsoever. Let's bring in another phone call here, Ben.
Hi, this is Ed from Chicago, Illinois. I was wondering about the Cadillac XTS. Since the XTS will be coming out soon, will there be a replacement for the new Impala or updated Impala? Thanks.
GM is working now, right now, led by John Cafaro, with a new rear-wheel drive Impala.
No relation to XTS.
No relation to XTS. So I'm looking forward to that because it's supposed to be the Ed Welburn has assured everyone that we are going for it with this car. So, boy, I hope they do.
George from Brooklyn again says, who's more poorly managed, Delta or General Motors?
I'd say Delta at this point, really.
He also wanted to ask John Krafcik, who we had on here last week, if he knew about or what they're doing about the transmission issues in the Genesis, Genesis Coupe, and Azera. I've not heard about them. This.
I'm not aware.
Yeah, okay. Thanks for the tip, George. We will be looking into this. Yeah. Jay Kuja wants to know, is Buick dropping the 3-liter V6 from the LaCrosse a good move, and why did it fail? And what we should point out is, they launched the LaCrosse with a 3-liter V6, the 3.6-liter high, whatever they call it, V6, and now they're putting in a turbo 2.4-liter, right? And now, but they just announced they're dropping the 3-liter. I'm not sure what the reason is. They probably just decided they didn't need two V6s available in this car.
Yeah, I think that's it.
Ben, I think we've still got another phone call there.
Hey, John. This is Chris from Baltimore, Maryland, originally Michigander.
All right.
Thanks again for the free tickets to the Washington Auto Show.
Oh, cool.
I was wondering what everybody thought about the restart of the Saab production line. And any comments or ideas on how the new 9.5 will do in the United States? Thanks. Bye.
Good point. Saab has essentially been out of the car business for a year now. They just relaunched production. There are cars coming across the Atlantic as we speak. Again, I'd say tune into Autoline Detroit. We'll have it up on our website tomorrow afternoon at AutolineDetroit.tv. All those questions get answered. We show you the 9.5 in there. It's a pretty good-looking car. And to my eye, I've only seen the video. I haven't seen the actual car. it's probably the best looking Saab there's been in a long, long time. But the question is, can Saab get back and going again? Last year in the United States, they sold fewer than 9,000 cars. Globally, they sold 93,000 or 96,000. I mean, less than one half of one assembly plant. They got to fill that assembly plant. If they don't do that, I don't care what happens. They just are not going to survive. And it's that's the real tough thing that they're.
And then it'll be the biggest sob story of them all.
Somebody had to say it.
Jim from Sioux Falls, South Dakota, wrote in to say, a few decades ago, you knew you had a cool car if there was a popular song about it. For example, Little GTO, 409, Red Corvette from Prince. Is there any car today that's cool enough to have a popular song written about it?
I don't see Lady Gaga doing an ode to the Nissan Cube or anything. I don't know. It's just, there's a disconnect. I mean, you know, we grew up in a different era. I mean, the mobility, the excitement of the mobility of the 60s, it just brought it out of everything, and I don't think we're going to see
that. I can't get my nephews interested in cars at all. They couldn't care less. It's a different world, sort of, sadly.
I wouldn't give up on that because
not everybody, but I just think that culturally
there's been some
culturally it's all about your phone. It's not about your car.
Yeah. Great.
There's
point.
Been some country songs with vehicles in them of
True.
Late.
Sure. That's right.
So at least it's still alive in country. But you make a good point. Tom, it's just like everyone's getting all geeked about their mobile devices and stuff.
Right.
Like. Makes me want to go drive
something
about real
fast. They're worried about when does 4G hit rather than when does the fall model launch.
It just makes me want to go out and drive something real fast, real far away from everybody.
Well, we got Ricardo Rojas from Mexico wrote in. I'll just sort of paraphrase it. I don't know if you guys saw the stat that BMW came out with this week that said 70% or was it 80% of everybody who drives a 1 Series thinks it's a front-wheel drive car. And he says, I always thought the hatchback wasn't a BMW type of car. No offense to anybody, but here in Mexico, we always relate that kind of car, that body type, to a Volkswagen Rabbit or a Golf, not as a BMW. Although we don't get a hatchback 1 Series in the United States. And I think whoever it was from BMW that was saying that was talking about Europe anyway, which is an even more astonishing sort of revelation that most of the people who bought a 1 Series thought that it's front drive. And so my rejoinder is, no wonder they're dropping the tagline, the ultimate driving machine. I mean, people don't even know they have an ultimate driving machine.
I wonder if that statistic was just to try and excuse the fact that they are planning to come out with a front-wheel drive. Wow, everyone already thinks they've got front-wheel drive, so adding front-wheel drive is no big deal.
I just think BMW needs to do a reincarnation of the 2002 and do it right, rear-wheel drive, four-cylinder, decontented, really simple but cool to look at, and instead they're going to do their version of the Mini. They already do the Mini. Why do they need to do the BMW version of the Mini? So they need a 2002 successor.
Dave Britton from Fort Wayne, Indiana says, I see that some of the most expensive cars on the planet are prone to fires in the engine compartment. Has there been any recalls of supercars, or do we just hear about the mass-produced brands?
I think we probably just hear about the mass-produced ones. I don't know about recalls of...
Well, recalls, supercars, just a guy's getting on the phone and say, hey, you got to get these back into the shop.
Well, the reality of supercars is very few of them do 15,000 miles a year.
Yeah.
And so whatever it is, you're not going to... I mean, they're just different animals. I don't know if any big recalls on Ferraris or anything.
I will say this. I've got a buddy named Jeff Swart, who I'm sure a lot of enthusiasts have heard and seen his work. He gets 911s, and I got to say, Jeff drives the living piss out of the 911. He'll put 35,000. You'll see him pull up on a chute. It'll have stone chips and bugs all over it, and he enjoys his cars, and that's to be praised.
Unusual. Chris Liddell, the new CFO at General Motors, was saying that he drove his Ferrari to work every day in Seattle.
Well, he put snow tires on.
He put snow tires on his Ferrari when he's working for Microsoft.
Well, this guy might be okay then.
Yeah.
That's not half bad.
He's an Aussie. So. Or is it New Zealander? Right.
New Zealander.
Yeah.
Here's from Mike D. White saying, what's your take on this concern that overturning the EPA endangerment finding on greenhouse gases would cause California to back out of its agreement for a national fuel economy standard? Dead silence. I'll answer that. No, I mean, there is a move afoot largely on the Republican side of things to challenge this national problem with CO2 and saying that the government, the federal government, can't regulate it. It's up to the states. And the auto industry is worried about this because now we have a deal where California's on board to go with a national standard, because the last thing that the auto industry wants to do
is five
seeing
different
all standards. Different kinds of states come up with all kinds of different standards. They want one standard. So as far as the auto industry is concerned, they love the California CO2 standard that's now been meshed in with the national standard.
As long as they don't change it again.
Yeah. Just don't change it. That's
you know,
exactly.
We can't have a bratwurst standard in Wisconsin and, you know.
That's right. Let's see. Well, you know, I want to find one more question here because we are at the top of the hour. We should be wrapping up. But what else is there? Okay, George wrote in to say the Sonata may be the first midsize car to go with only a four-cylinder, but the Buick Regal was designed and engineered during the same time frame and will be available shortly. George must be with Buick. But I think that's a good place to wrap it up. But Tom Walsh from the Detroit Free Press, great having you here.
Well, good to be here, and we're going to see that Buick Regal soon, right? And we're going to see. Yeah, it's a big car for Buick.
Yeah, that's a very important one. And Frank Marcus from Motor Trend, great having you here.
And I'm in the market, in that market space, actually, because my household, we only buy small four-cylinder loaded nice cars, and when my TSX, you know, craps out, that Regal will be on the list. We'll see.
It looks like a very nice car.
And Peter DeLorenzo, the auto extremist, thank you for being here, too, as always.
I'm going to get in my Audi S4 and drive as fast as I can. Because the creeping pod cars and the pod people are going to track us down and shoot us like wild dogs in the streets. It's going to be ugly.
It's up to us to be the yin to their yang.
Yes, that's true.
Hey, remember, you can friend us on Facebook.com/AutolineDetroit. You can follow us at Twitter.com/AutoLine. You can read Peter's stuff every day of the week, but you should especially check out his columns on Wednesdays. At AutoExtremist.com. Tom Walsh, you can always read his stuff at Freep.com, F-R-E-E-P.com.
Actually known to natives here as the Freep.
The Freep for the Detroit Free Press, but Freep.com is the website. And Frank stuff at MotorTrend.com.
I actually had a tweet frenzy yesterday.
You did?
Yeah.
Over what?
Well, I just decided to do it, and all these guys came out of the woodwork and said, you know, it was like, what's wrong with you? And then I said, well, I got to go. I'm done for the. And then one guy wrote in and said, okay, see you in another 6 months. But I am on Twitter at AutoExtremist.
Yeah, I never tweet, and yet every now and then I get these so-and-so is now following you on Twitter. I'm like, oh, he's going to be disappointed.
Yeah, I get that a lot.
And remember, we told you about Stitcher. You can listen to this show and our other shows on your smartphone or your BlackBerry. You can check all that stuff out on our website. And thanks for tuning in.
Visit our website, AutolineDetroit.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern, get your daily automotive news fix with AutoLine Daily, and in-depth analysis and interviews with AutoLine Detroit. That's all there, and much more, at AutolineDetroit.tv.
AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone. Passion for excellence.